It is Saturday, July 18th. We are checking in on the week's remaining friction points before you head into the weekend. The Grade 1 Haskell at Monmouth Park is this weekend. It serves as a qualifier for the Breeders' Cup Classic at Keeneland. Trainers are currently weighing the risk of running their three-year-olds again before the October championship, balancing the need for a win against the danger of burning out their prospects. It is a high-stakes tactical game. If a horse wins at Monmouth, the trainer has to decide whether to train straight into the Classic or squeeze in another race like the Traverse to keep the horse sharp. That is the modern reality of racing, the constant, shitty trade-off between keeping a horse at peak condition and avoiding the fatigue of a heavy schedule. Contrast that with the late 19th century. The horse Hindu won 18 consecutive races in one season back in 1881. His trainer, James Rowe, ran him in stakes races separated by as little as 5 days, and he did it across distances ranging from 1 mile to 2 miles. Hindu retired with 30 wins in 35 starts and became a successful sire, proving that a grueling, high-frequency career didn't necessarily kill a horse's value. We look at that today and call it an impossible standard. Honestly, I think we have just decided that modern horses are either too fragile or too expensive to risk that kind of intensity. But there is a bigger problem than just training philosophies. The infrastructure of the sport is currently rotting from the inside out. Hawthorne Race Course in Illinois is facing a potential sale to a non-racing entity. If that sale goes through, it would leave the state with only one active track at Fairmount Park in Collinsville. Losing a hub like Chicago is not just about a missing venue. It destroys the local breeding and training pipeline. And when the infrastructure in a major market collapses, the talent and the bettors just go elsewhere. It is a death spiral of regional isolation. When tracks cannot compete with local casinos or manage their tax burdens, they close. The sport is pushed into remote, downstate locations where it cannot attract new fans. You end up with a smaller, more insular industry that is disconnected from the population centers it needs to actually stay alive. Then there is the communication gap. Look at what happened at Saratoga recently. Safety concerns regarding turf races were ignored until the very last second, which forced a cancellation of the Pick Six. Management and the jockey guilds aren't talking to each other, and the result is chaos. When you have management in one silo and participants in another, the horse player is the one who loses out. If a bettor cannot trust that a race day will actually happen, they are going to take their money somewhere else that is actually reliable. There is also a weird, unspoken friction between the people who bet on these races and the people who ride in them. Handicappers want to see jockeys force the pace if a race is slow. Jockeys, meanwhile, have every incentive to save their horse and avoid riding them into the ground. You end up with a market that does not account for the collective passivity of the field. It is a fundamental misalignment of expectations. The industry is trying to sell a product that depends on predictability and high-density markets. But right now, the sport is shrinking geographically. The communication between the people running it is non-existent, and the internal incentives between the riders and the bettors are completely at odds. You can have all the elite horses you want, but if you don't have a place for them to run or a fan base that trusts the product, you are just running in place. It is a hell of a thing to watch, a sport lose its own foundation, while everyone involved is too busy blaming each other to see the floor falling out. Let's look at the mess happening within the Democratic Party. The party is currently debating what it means to be electable in modern America. In Michigan, the Senate primary has become a proxy war between establishment Democrats and progressive insurgents. Establishment figures argue the middle lane is the only path to victory in a general election. Progressive candidates argue that the middle is a theoretical construct that fails to address the economic grievances of the working class. It is a fundamental disagreement over whether you win by courting swing voters or by mobilizing a base that feels ignored. The establishment warns that progressive platforms alienate the broad coalition needed to win. Progressives claim that establishment gatekeeping is the real liability. They are bypassing traditional media and endorsements entirely. They seem to view aggressive negative campaigns from the party center as a badge of honor. It validates their narrative that they are a genuine threat to the status quo. The funding dynamic here is predictably messy. Outside groups are flooding local primaries with cash. This forces candidates to spend their energy defending their donor ties instead of talking about the issues. It creates a feedback loop of cynicism. Voters are starting to see these people as agents of their financial backers rather than representatives of their own interests. Then you have the other side of this coin in New York City. State Assemblyman and mayoral candidate Zoran Mamdani, pronounced Zohran Mamdani, is campaigning on a platform of rent freezes, expanded childcare, and lowering violent crime. He is trying to prove that a progressive can build a coalition that includes both grassroots activists and technocratic figures. Mamdani is betting that if you deliver the goods, people will overlook the ideological labels. He is choosing operational success to protect his affordability agenda. But he is also refusing to moderate on foreign policy. He links international spending directly to domestic needs. He argues that if a politician cannot be honest about foreign conflicts, they cannot be trusted to fight for housing or healthcare at home. It is a high-stakes experiment. He is trying to build a big tent by defining the working class as anyone who works to afford the dignities of life. It is a smart pivot, but it comes with a risk. If the tent gets too big, the focus on the material change that drives his platform might get diluted. Meanwhile, the broader political system is starting to look like a shitty situation. The reliance on devil's bargains is becoming the default governing strategy. Politicians are either forced to abandon their principles to maintain power, or they maintain their integrity and lose the ability to influence anything at all. We are seeing this in the erosion of institutional norms. Take the confirmation of Todd Blanche as Deputy Attorney General earlier this year. The argument for his confirmation was that the alternative might be worse than an imperfect nominee. If the Senate rejects these choices, we end up with a permanent state of acting officials. It bypasses oversight and gives the executive branch too much room to maneuver. The Republican Party is dealing with its own version of this. The MAGAification of the party is pushing out institutionalists regardless of their experience. If you are a Republican who tries to play by the old rules, you are getting steamrolled by populist insurgents. It shifts the party toward a model where loyalty to the leader is replacing the rule of law as the main currency of survival. There is a real danger in all of this. We are defaulting to a candidate pool that favors the shameless over the qualified. If the game demands a level of cynicism that turns away normal people, you end up with a government run by celebrities or people who just do not have the inhibition to care about public scrutiny. The takeaway here is that this is not a sustainable way to run a country. It is a cycle of diminishing returns. Organizations that cannot tell the difference between a tactical compromise and the erosion of their own foundational principles are going to lose the ability to govern. The cost of maintaining power is currently the destruction of the very systems they are supposed to be leading, which, honestly, is a hell of a thing to say with a straight face. The internal politics of party platforms are messy enough, but when you look at the current international soccer landscape, the math is at least slightly more predictable. Spain and Argentina are heading to a tournament final. Spain reached this stage by relying on possession and defensive control, having conceded only one goal throughout the tournament. Argentina has taken a different path, marked by a tendency to overcome deficits and shift tactics when they are pushed into a corner. The betting markets are reacting to these two identities. Spain's defensive record makes them a high probability bet, but that consistency often means the price of betting on them is inflated. Argentina's volatility creates a different kind of opportunity. If Spain takes an early lead, the game script forces Argentina into a more desperate, high-risk posture. That shift historically increases the likelihood of high-scoring outcomes and a higher count of fouls. Here is the thing about the third-place match between France and England. It is a completely different animal. Motivation for these teams is low, and the traditional metrics used to predict winners start to decouple from reality. The goal for many players shifts from team success to individual milestones like the Golden Boot race. That makes it a minefield for standard bets. The smart money is moving away from match winner markets and toward contingency-based parlays that account for individual incentives. If you are still betting on team quality in these final games, you are probably looking at the wrong set of data. The fantasy landscape is mirroring this shift, but with a sharper focus on roster management. The advice for managers is to lean heavily into Spanish assets like Lamine Yamal, pronounced Lamien Yamal, and Dani Olmo, along with defenders like Pedro Porro and Mark Cucurella, pronounced Cucurella. The data suggests these players offer far higher projected returns than the current options from the England or France squads. Management strategies for the final stretch require a total reset. The third-place playoff is effectively a data-gathering exercise for rotation patterns, because squads are likely to rotate heavily. Waiting for official team sheets is non-negotiable. Using your free transfers to purge non-playing assets is the only way to avoid the volatility of a condensed schedule. Look, it is a hell of a strategy to shift everything based on a few games. But the reality is that the predictive power of best team metrics dies the moment the tournament enters its final phase. It is easy to get caught up in the reputation of players like Harry Kane or Kylian Mbappé, pronounced K-E-E-L-A-N M-B-A-P-P-E. But relying on those names is a liability right now. Club-level pressures to prevent injuries mean these stars are at a high risk of being substituted early or rested entirely. The tournament is no longer about which team has the most talent on paper. It is about who is actually playing, how desperate they are to score, and whether they are chasing a trophy or a personal award. If you are still playing the game as if it is the group stages, you are going to get burned. The edge now sits with the people who treat the final and the bronze medal match as two distinct, high-stakes events. It is not about the history of the team. It is about the math of the next 90 minutes. That is rarely as clean as the pundits want it to be. But that is exactly why the betting lines look the way they do. The tech sector is currently trying to buy its way out of uncertainty, though it is not going well. The AI market is showing signs of a structural correction. Market valuations for firms like OpenAI and Anthropic are currently built on massive, unsustainable spending on token consumption. Enterprise users are now shifting away from this aggressive adoption toward demanding measurable productivity gains. Since the 10 most valuable companies in the S&P 500 currently account for 43% of the index market cap, a correction here threatens broader economic stability. It is a classic case of a circular financing loop. Infrastructure providers, startups, and enterprise clients are all propping up a model that only works as long as everyone keeps overspending. Scott Galloway points out that when the bill finally comes due, and companies realize that adding AI to a spreadsheet doesn't actually double their output, the revenue projections justifying these valuations are going to crater. The winners, if there are any, won't be the shareholders of these high-burn firms. They will be the customers who eventually get the technology at a fraction of the current cost. It's a hell of a gamble to build the economy on a business model that relies on its own customers going broke to sustain it. Meanwhile, we are seeing equally fragile systems in our oceans, though for entirely different reasons. Marine conservation policies are currently failing because they rely on outdated size-based management rules. Regulators often set minimum size limits for fishing, assuming that fish simply get bigger as they age. In reality, many species, like the parrotfish, change sex as they grow. When we target only the largest fish, we are inadvertently wiping out the entire male population. This creates a demographic bottleneck that makes it impossible for the species to reproduce. It is a brutal oversight. We aren't just overfishing. We are effectively performing a mass, unintended sterilization of the ocean. It turns out that managing a complex ecosystem requires more than just a ruler and a spreadsheet. Human-induced environmental changes are also scrambling the chemical signals that lobsters and other species need to find mates. Acidification and chemical runoff from land act like a contraceptive, leaving females unable to communicate and males unable to behave. We tend to think of pollution as a water quality issue, but it is actually a total disruption of the fundamental biological imperative to reproduce. We are essentially breaking the reproductive clockwork of the ocean because we can't be bothered to understand how it ticks. This brings us to the deep sea, where the risks are even more hidden. Industrial activities like deep-sea mining for rare earth minerals are moving forward in environments we haven't even documented yet. Octopuses use deep-sea sponges to lay their eggs, but these habitats are being slated for destruction before we even know how these creatures live. We are prioritizing resource extraction in environments where we possess zero understanding of the biological stakes. It's interesting to compare these two worlds. On one hand, you have the AI bubble, where we are over-engineering a system that doesn't actually produce the value it claims to. On the other hand, you have the natural world, where we are destroying systems that have spent millennia perfecting the art of survival. There is a strange irony in the study of sacoglossan, pronounced sacoglossan, sea slugs. These creatures have evolved to steal chloroplasts from the algae they eat, basically turning themselves into solar-powered animals. They survive for months on a single meal by harvesting energy from the sun. Researchers are now looking at these slugs to understand how they bypass traditional metabolic boundaries. It's a reminder that biological innovation often hides in the most overlooked, spineless species. We are busy trying to build synthetic intelligence to solve all our problems, while nature has already mastered the kind of energy efficiency that our tech sector can only dream of. The lesson here seems to be that complexity isn't always a sign of strength. Sometimes, it's just a sign of how easily a system can fall apart when you remove one tiny, invisible piece. And while those tech giants struggle with their own complexity, there is a whole lot of other noise you should probably hear about. A few other things worth knowing today. First, robotic elder care is officially hitting the mainstream. It sounds convenient, but it turns out that delegating physical tasks to a machine makes it way too easy for families to drift away emotionally. It is a relief trap, and honestly, your grandma deserves a human visitor, not a glorified Roomba. Next, look at what you are feeding your brain. Constantly doom-scrolling through social media outrage burns up the cognitive bandwidth you actually need for complex work. If you spend your morning angry at a stranger on the internet, you are effectively lobotomizing your own ability to solve actual problems for the rest of the day. Finally, remember the Don Cornelius model. He insisted on owning his media property rather than selling it to a network, which kept the show authentic and gave him total creative control. It is a hell of a lesson on building a cultural moat, because when you don't answer to a boardroom, you don't have to apologize for who you are. That is the update for today. I will see you back here tomorrow.